The agenda for the talk today will be we'll address Reiki practice, history, and philosophy, then Reiki in conventional care, and Reiki research, and of course, time permitting, anything else about Reiki that you want to know. So, definition of the practice. Reiki is a spiritual or vibrational healing practice. I'm going to pull that apart. Spiritual, vibrational, notice I'm not talking religion here. Okay? Religion involves dogma, a belief system. Reiki does not. Another word you could use instead of spiritual or vibrational is subtle. It's very subtle, as you felt, you know, it's very subtle, and yet the response to Reiki touch can be quite subtly dramatic. It's a healing practice, so healing. We're not talking about cure. We're talking about healing. Cure requires an outside authority to let us know if that's happening. Healing is something that we have to decide for ourselves, right? It's not dependent on tests. It's subjective, and it's ongoing. There's no beginning. There's no end. It's a continual process, and I often say to my students that it's no longer sufficient to have a healthy lifestyle. We need to have a healing lifestyle. We need to find or create moments of healing in our lives every day. And that takes me to the next word, practice. We're used to, in healthcare, speaking about therapies or interventions. Reiki is a spiritual healing practice. It can be used therapeutically. It can be used as an intervention in an emergency alongside conventional medical care. But it's very important that we stay with its roots. It is a spiritual healing practice. And this means that the people who offer Reiki to other people, it's best if they're also offering Reiki to themselves. I learned to practice Reiki in 1986, and I've practiced self-treatment every day since then. And from my self-treatment, I'm able to share Reiki with other people, both my family, friends, and my clients. Reiki promotes systemic balance. Reiki is not symptom or condition specific. Reiki is not a conventional medical technique. It's a traditional healing practice, and all of the indigenous medical systems that I've studied aim for balancing the overall system. And they may have specific interventions to address conditions, but they never lose sight of the overall system. The foundation is self-treatment, and we can also receive treatment from family, friends, or professionals. The advantage here is that when there is a family addressing a health challenge or when someone is under hospice care, any members of the family who are interested and the patient, him or herself, can learn to practice. And then you can engage the family in a culture of wellness and healing. This is, of course, particularly helpful when there is a child who is ill, because the family quickly reorganizes around the care that the child needs. And this gives the family something that they can do that's about wellness. And the child also can learn to practice. I've trained many children with developmental delays, but only when at least one parent will be trained. The description of Reiki treatment is light touch. It's generally facilitated through light touch to a fully clothed recipient who can be seated as you all just were or is lying on a treatment table. A quiet clinical setting is always desirable, but it's not necessary. Reiki can be given at the scene of an accident, in the ER. I myself have offered Reiki to patients in the OR with Mehmet Oz and some of his colleagues. There's no diagnosis needed. Again, I'm going to keep stressing this. Reiki is a practice. So we don't have to know what's wrong with someone, nor do we even have to have the perspective that there's something wrong. Reiki is about balance and enhancement. And as such, could be appropriate for anyone who's interested. And there's no intention required. There are many fine, subtle healing techniques available, and I make use of a lot of them myself. I love acupuncture. I love shiatsu. I love marmotherapy. You know, what else? Therapeutic touch, healing touch. I mean, there's so many things.
Qigong.
Medical qigong, tai chi. All of those require intention on the part of the practitioner. So I'm not saying that therefore they are less, not at all. But the fact that the practitioner does not need to have the intention to be sharing Reiki means that it has a very wide applicability, because healthcare professionals and physicians can learn to practice Reiki for their own well-being, and then whenever they're touching patients, they carry the potential for that Reiki connection to activate in their hands, and it can happen during the course of routine care when the clinician's mind and intention is elsewhere. There is a protocol, there are a number of protocols that are used, different Reiki practitioners use different protocols, but the delivery of a Reiki treatment is very flexible and can be adapted to any situation. For example, when I was in the OR, I was always at the head, but the anesthesiologist also liked that real estate, so you know, we had to kind of negotiate a relationship, and it helped that they knew that both the patient and the surgeon wanted me there. Reiki can be given as a standalone treatment or delivered during routine procedures and care. Spa treatment, so that's what you just had, spa treatment. And we see that somebody experienced benefit from headache. Other people felt just more relaxed. How many people felt more centered or somehow the minds were clearer? That's another common experience. And a full protocol, again, it varies tremendously from practitioner to practitioner and also in different situations. But if you're going to a professional or receiving a full treatment from a friend, it's generally between 45 and 75 minutes of hands-on care. In a hospital, it could be anywhere from 5 minutes to 20 minutes if you're really lucky. The receiver need not be conscious. And there's no belief required. The person just has to be open enough to be willing, you know, informed consent where that is applicable. So Reiki is not energy medicine, as are the other techniques that I mentioned. Reiki, you could think of it more like an applied meditation. And how many people felt a bit meditative as a result of their sample? Great. Reiki's distinguishing characteristics, it's holistic, whole person care, no matter how invasive whatever else is happening. I mean, imagine being in surgery, what could be more invasive? And a lot of the surgical work that I did was in heart transplantation. It's kind of invasive, it's kind of wonderful, but it's pretty invasive. And to have at the same time something influencing the system back to balance. Reiki is effective in self-care regardless one's state of health or mind. I started working in conventional healthcare in the early 1990s at GMHC, Gay Men's Health Crisis, where I was asked to create a Reiki program, and I trained people who were suffering with AIDS or were at least HIV positive to practice on themselves. This was before the advent of the protease inhibitors. Some of these people were so sick that they practically slept through the entire class, but they still were able to practice on themselves. And then the way I got called into hospital, because I have no medical credentials. I mean, this is real integrative medicine here. I have no medical credentials, right? But enough doctors who were doing HIV treatment saw that their patients who were doing better than they would have expected kept mentioning Reiki. Reiki, 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 Pamela Miles, GMHC. And from that connection, when Beth Israel started their complementary therapies program at their outpatient AIDS clinic, I was asked to be part of it. And the rest is history, as they say. So Reiki is easily learned at the entry level. I've taught children, and my oldest student was in her 90s. She was a Holocaust survivor. Anybody who wants to learn Reiki can learn Reiki at the first level. And this is very important. There are no known medical contraindications. Massage is a wonderful modality. And yet there are times when people are not able to safely receive massage. But Reiki is always safe, and here's why. I know that's a very big statement to make. Reiki touch is non-manipulative. Okay? It's not massage. It's just very light contact. And if necessary, it can be off the body. If there are lesions, if there's a port, if there's an IV insertion, if there's a burn, for example, if there's any reason why you can't touch, then you don't touch, but you just get close. And finally, there's no substance ingested or applied. So by the medical scientific paradigm, there's nothing happening here that could be dangerous. The worst that could be said is that maybe Reiki doesn't help, and I'm going to address that, but even if that were true, clinicians know that the patient receiving more attention is a happier patient, right? And a happier patient, a patient who feels cared for, is easier to take care of. Commonly reported benefits of Reiki: relaxation, pain management, reduced anxiety. In fact, in the early HIV classes that I had, we had students fill out standardized indices for pain and anxiety before and after their self-treatment and treating one another. These were students who were still engaged in the class, and we found a significant reduction in pain and anxiety, whether they were treating themselves or receiving treatment from someone else. And there has also been a number of other studies that have indicated that reduced depression, improved sleep, improved digestion, enhanced well-being, stronger self-esteem, support for substance abuse recovery. Of course, stronger self-esteem often translates to greater self-agency, right? Many people don't take good care of themselves because they don't feel that they can. They don't feel that anything they do makes a difference. So Reiki can be helpful with that. Accelerated surgical recovery. No data that I know of, but it's commonly reported. Reduced side effects from radiation, chemo, and prescription medications. Greater self-awareness and greater ease and satisfaction in relationship and heightened intuition. Traditionally, we have three levels of training. The first degree, which is what you all just experienced, light touch or proximity. 8 to 12 hours of training, and I ask my students to practice every day. I ask them that frequently, to practice every day, self-treatment, for a minimum of 3 months before learning second degree. But I don't even encourage them to learn second degree. It's not necessary. It's just sometimes people want to. Maybe the person is a psychotherapist, for example. I have a lot of psychiatrists that I train because they feel that touch is not within their scope of practice, but they want to add another avenue of healing. And that training is, again, 8 to 12 hours. And traditionally, and there are no standards, there's no regulation around Reiki training or practice, but traditionally one would practice second degree for 2 to 10 years before training as a Reiki master, and train as a Reiki master only if one felt called to teach. Okay? So Reiki master, being a Reiki master, is not necessarily a better clinician, but it's at that is the level at which you can teach other people to practice. And traditionally, that's done through a minimum 1 year apprenticeship with a fully qualified Reiki master. So, how come no diplomas? Oh, I'm self-taught. Right? This is funny when you think of it in a medical situation because it could never happen. It's not quite as funny when you think of it that there are Reiki practitioners who think that they can teach themselves to practice Reiki, and that's not the case. So, since the credentialing, there is no field-wide regulation of credentialing, how can you identify a credible Reiki practitioner? It's really not very hard. You know, you ask for some information. You're looking for comprehensive training. That the levels are taken separately over time, and that the practitioner has ongoing mentoring. And also, a first-degree practitioner could be fine for a hospital practice. There's no reason why you need a second-degree practitioner. I'd rather have a first-degree practitioner who has some depth of experience. You know, ask the person, what have you done? Who have you given Reiki to? In what situations? Ask about the person's vision of the role of Reiki in collaborative care. So you learn a lot of their understanding there, but also realize that as healthcare professionals, you might help the practitioner out here. You know, if you've connected with somebody that you think would be a good fit, but he or she doesn't really have a vision of collaborative care because this is new to her, then this is something that you could do some training. Look at the overall demeanor. I teach classes for practitioners who want to learn to collaborate in conventional healthcare, and one of the first things I tell them is lose your enthusiasm, okay? Because we've experienced so much benefit from Reiki, and we often are very excited about it. We see the possibilities. We want to share it with everybody, and it doesn't fly in medicine where decisions are made very conservatively and people are used to making choices on the basis of evidence. So what we want to do is have that kind of professional demeanor, put out what is known, carefully delineate what is backed by research, what is anecdotal, and then let the medical and healthcare professionals step forward if they're interested. You're looking for the ability to articulate Reiki. Reiki is so easy to practice at the first degree level that many, many people can practice, and they really don't have a lot of understanding of what's happening, and they're not able to speak about it credibly. But if you're a professional, and particularly if you're looking to collaborate in healthcare, you need to do that. You need to be able to speak. Not to be a medical wannabe, but to be able to speak about Reiki in a way that makes sense to professionals. And finally, and this is the deal-breaker question for me, do you practice Reiki on yourself every day? I really would not want to have a Reiki practitioner, either privately as a professional or in a healthcare environment, who is not practicing Reiki every day, because that's how we continue to understand and learn about Reiki. Okay? It's a practice. It's not an intervention. Reiki history, this is an area where there's a lot of misinformation. Sometimes it's said to be an ancient Tibetan Buddhist practice, but Tibetan Buddhism is not ancient. It dates back to Mikao Usui, who mainly taught between 1922 and 26. He trained over 2,000 Japanese, but he only made 16 Reiki masters. So from the beginning of this practice, being a Reiki master was something that was distinct from the rest of the practice. And then he had a student, Chujiro Hayashi, who excerpted the hands placements, the Usui Teate, it was called then. It's Usui's practices were largely meditation, and there were some hand placements. And then Hayashi said to Usui, well, what about for people who don't have this burning spiritual desire, but they want to take better care of themselves? You know, even then there was a concern about how invasive what we sometimes still call Western medicine, but it was already being practiced in Japan then, how invasive that could be, and what about people who just want to take better care of themselves? Do you think that these healing practices would work separately from the meditation? So together, they developed another manual that explored this, and then Hawayo Takada was a first-generation Japanese-American who was in Japan, received profound healing from Hayashi's clinic. She went every day for months to receive this profound healing. And then she and Hayashi brought Reiki to the U.S. And they brought a version of Reiki practice that was simplified from even what Hayashi was teaching in Japan, because they understood, for one thing, we were on the brink of war with Japan. And so there was a lot of political pressure. But also, there are cultural supports to the practice of Reiki in Japan that just did not exist in the U.S. So I often refer to it as Reiki for dummies, myself being one of those dummies. Reiki philosophy, you know, really Reiki doesn't have a lot of philosophy attached to it, but it is important to realize that it was based in a non-dual culture, that there is this perspective of a vibrational continuum that is consistent with conventional physics. In physics, there's a placeholder term called the unified field. There is an understanding that although there's no scientific evidence of it yet, there must be a level of reality at yet undiscovered, but that is universal. And in Reiki, we would refer to that unified field as Reiki. The focus has always been on practice, not philosophy. In fact, Mrs. Takata would maybe answer a question or two in her training, but mostly she would just say, just do it, long before Nike. You know, she would say, practice, 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 and you will know. And there are Reiki precepts. You may have come across these already. The understanding that Usui had is that most of our lives are lived between Reiki practices, so something to keep our awareness focused. Today only, do not worry, do not anger. With thankfulness, work diligently, and the work in that is practice. With gratefulness for having this practice, practice diligently, practice regularly, and be kind to others. So, you know, very simple. This is the Reiki Kanji. Reiki use in conventional care. When I wrote a paper, Reiki Review for Alternative Therapies, I think it was published in 2003, I scoured the medical literature and found, even then, that was almost 6 years ago, evidence of Reiki already being used in conventional medical environments in all of these different departments. And, you know, all of this is in the, when you get, they don't have a proceedings, right, but you can download it. I put medical papers there that include all of this. These are from my experience, my clinical experience, that I have either offered treatment to or trained and or trained people who are addressing these health issues. But when people call me and say, you know, have you treated cancer before? What do you think I say? No, I don't treat cancer. Reiki doesn't treat cancer. Reiki balances people, and that can help their bodies address whatever symptoms or conditions, or support the conventional approach to cure. So there are three tiers of Reiki usage. The first is the public using Reiki in self-treatment and for family and friends. This is the foundation. This is how Usui taught it, Reiki for us. Reiki for the community, Reiki for individuals. But in the last 20 years, there's been a growing body of professional Reiki practitioners in private practice. Do we have any here? We have a few. Great. And what we're seeing more and more is medical and healthcare providers who are incorporating Reiki into conventional care, like moments of Reiki to soothe invasive procedures such as bone marrow biopsy, or having massage that starts or ends with brief Reiki touch, or massage therapists tell me when they get to a place where, you know, they either sense that there's a lot of fear, a lot of holding, or the muscle is just like a rock, they'll place their hands, if they're Reiki trained, at that part of the body, and they feel a softening and a release that enables them to proceed with their treatment. and medical referrals for Reiki training and or treatment. So many doctors aren't so much learning to practice themselves, but they see that there's some benefit and they're connecting with Reiki professionals in their community and referring patients. Give it to me straight, doc. How long do I have to ignore your advice? So all the healthcare practitioners in the room know what this is like. And maybe it should say to ignore your very good advice, because it's not that patients don't think that the doctor's advice is worthwhile. So why is compliance such a problem? Or adherence, I think, is now the politically correct term to use. Okay, so how Reiki supports conventional care. It calms the patient, and a calm patient is easier to treat, and this may lead to a reduced demand for medications. Like if this lady in green had come to the doctor for a headache, you know, and 30 seconds of Reiki and the headache went away, and that doesn't always happen, but it does sometimes. A reduced need for unnecessary intervention. When patients receive Reiki, they feel seen, they feel cared for, and then they're not so anxious and demanding. This can lead to greater comprehension and thus greater compliance. What I see is a lot of time patients don't follow their doctor's advice because they haven't really understood it. You know, they don't feel well. They're sitting there in the office and they don't feel well, and they don't feel like they can connect with their doctor again to ask for lots of reasons, and none of that is the doctor's fault. I mean, doctors are really busy. And an enhanced patient-provider rapport. Reiki can aid diagnosis through sensitizing the hands of clinicians who touch patients during routine care, and it can ease the transition from curative medicine to palliative medicine. Physicians in particular are trained to intervene. And when their interventions are deemed to no longer be effective, it can be challenging for them to hang around because they have other patients whom they could be helping, and they feel helpless. I'm sharing this because this is what my students who are doctors have told me, so I don't mean to be pretentious here and to understand where doctors are coming from. I'm just parroting back to you what they tell me. But then once they've been trained in Reiki, they realize that their presence, you know, just holding a patient's hand, just resting a hand on the shoulder, that this is enough of a do to help the doctor realize that there's still something that he or she offers the patient. Of course, the patient would be happy anyway to see the doctor come by regardless. So Reiki can humanize medical practice by giving staff a no-touch comfort intervention that can be applied simultaneously with invasive interventions. Patients who feel cared for, let's be pragmatic here, they're less likely to sue, right? You know, we see very low incidence of malpractice suits among CAM providers. And we don't know all the reasons for that, but it seems that one reason is that there's greater rapport for lots of reasons, because CAM providers generally have more time to spend with their patients. But if moments of Reiki touch can enhance rapport, this could be useful. Reiki includes staff in the circle of healing. Remember before when I said that there's no intention? So Reiki is something, Reiki touch is something that a Reiki-trained staff member can provide for a patient without any cost to herself. And what the staff tell me is that they enjoy offering Reiki. And so if they can offer Reiki to one another, that's a good thing. But even just the moments that they're able to offer Reiki touch to patients, they also feel the benefit. It's not an outgoing intervention. It's more of a centering. You know, it's as if an image that I often use is that we all have a wellness gong within us, right? We have an inviolable center of wellness deep within us. And Reiki gives an access to that, because Reiki is a spiritual healing practice. And the goal of all spiritual practice is to connect with that unified field. Just jump in anytime, James.
I'm being entertained, so what can I tell you?
So, minutes of Reiki touch during conventional care can reduce anticipatory anxiety. Or children who are undergoing chemo can learn to practice Reiki on themselves. You know, sometimes kids start throwing up when they see the cab that's going to take them to their chemo. And I have trained children in this situation, and at least one parent, and they find that practicing Reiki can soothe that. Can soothe patient undergoing invasive procedures, comfort abuse patients. You know, if you have a rape victim that you're treating, often she or he doesn't want to be touched, you know. So again, it can be the off-the-body touch. A few minutes can really make somebody feel safe and comforted, and it can ease the rest of the exam. Reiki touch can relieve intractable pain, even sickle cell. And I've heard many, I myself have trained many sickle cell patients to practice on themselves and heard their feedback, but I've never had an opportunity to offer Reiki to someone who is in the throes of a sickle cell attack. But it's something that I've heard from many clinicians who have seen the difference that 5 to 10 minutes of Reiki touch can make to a sickle cell patient who cannot have any more medication and is in the hospital screaming, writhing. This is horrible for the patient. It's horrible for the rest of the patients, and it's also very hard on the staff. And what I hear is 5 to 10 minutes, the patient is either chatting amiably or asleep. Three avenues for integrating Reiki into hospital care. The staff can learn first degree. This is something that I've done in many hospitals. They use it for self-care, for their co-workers, and as we've been saying, integrating it into routine care. And some hospitals have Reiki practitioners on staff. In 1995, the CEO of Portsmouth Regional Hospital figured out that it would be well worth it to hire one lay Reiki master to offer treatment 5 days a week, and then she also supervised a group of very well-trained and regimented volunteers so that Reiki was available to patients 7 days a week. And he felt that what he spent on her salary would be saved in other expenses. We won't specify which one. Patients, family members, caregivers can learn first-degree Reiki through patient education programs. These are hospitals around the country where Reiki is being offered to patients. And, of course, we don't know the full scope of how Reiki is being used in conventional medicine because many staff members are just using it as part of their touch portfolio. But this is just a few of the hospitals where there are Reiki programs. A year or two ago, I thought I was preparing for a medical Reiki class I was giving, and I thought I'd just look through my inbox and see how many emails I had from different hospitals, mostly around the country, but sometimes in Europe or India, asking about Reiki. And just from that very non-academic research, I had over 60 hospitals in my inbox. You know, and I never followed up. I mean, I gave them leads, but I don't know how many of them incorporated it. Okay, I'm going to go past this. And this I just told you about. Okay, the clinical center of the NIH is where anyone undergoing, involved in a clinical trial receives their medical care. There's a pain and palliative care service that is available for all patients, also for their families and for caregivers and staff to the extent that they're stressed by their work. It was, when it was started, the only PPCS using CAM interventions as well as, you know, up-to-date conventional modalities. And I asked Ann Berger, who is a nurse before she became an oncologist, given the huge menu of interventions she had, what made her think of recommending Reiki? And she said that she thought of it especially for pain and anxiety, and the research backs that up. But the rest of it I found very interesting, because she said, and for the spiritual distress that can manifest as pain and anxiety. Because really, how many prescriptions do we have for spiritual distress? Do you want to talk about your clinical stuff and then we can come back to research?
Sure. I'll make a few comments. Before we came in here, I was out in the hallway, and one of my physician colleagues came by and saw that I was part of the presentation. She said to me, "Stand behind the speakers." She said to me, "You believe in that stuff? That stuff do anything?" And I looked at her and I said, "You know, I don't know." And that may sound like a kind of a funny answer. Some of you may be familiar with a woman physician named Rachel Remen. Rachel Naomi Remen, who's written some really great books, and physician at UCSF. She and Michael Lerner started the Commonweal Cancer Help Program, and she's pretty well known internationally. One of the things that Dr. Remen talks about is mystery. The role of mystery in healing and in our own internal health. And sometimes I go back to her very wise comments about that. Pamela's gone through a tremendous amount of really great material about this. And I always return to this notion that Dr. Remen talks about, that there are things that are mysteries, like the idea of the unified field. We know that it has to exist in terms of physics. And so if somebody says to me, as a Reiki practitioner, do you believe in this? I say, you know, I'm not sure. I use it. I practice it. It seems to make my patients feel better. Do I believe in it the way someone would have a religious belief? No, I don't. I see the papers. I know about the basics, and I think that that's really important. But again, it's really sort of about practice, practice, practice. For me, as a pain specialist, I started life as an acupuncturist and chiropractor trained in California, and I went to med school in Chicago and came here to New York and trained in internal medicine, rehab medicine, and pain. Worked at Beth Israel's Integrative Medicine Center for about 2 years, and with Russell Portnoy, who one of the great pain physicians of our time, has his own department at Beth Israel. And a clinical professor at Columbia for 17 years. Now I'm pretty much exclusively in the private practice. But having come from the quacky side of the fence and then gone through all the medical training and trained at an Ivy League medical center and been a professor there for many years, I live in these sort of diverse worlds that Pamela's talked about. And so for me, it's not really about belief. Do I believe in Augmentin? I treat people in pain, and there are often people who have already not done so well with a lot of the conventional stuff. They've not done so well with the pills and with some of the shots and also with some of the other practitioners that can usually make a lot of people feel better. My acupuncture colleagues, my chiropractic colleagues, my massage therapy colleagues, and for people who are having real problems, I'm sort of the last resort guy. I'd sort of like to be the first resort guy. So I can get a lot of people well pretty readily, but I seem to be the guy who troubleshoots the chronic pain situations. And so I use many tools in my practice, the nutritional changes that Dr. Bland was talking about. And I did train in Chinese medicine in California many years ago, and I was very interested in Qigong. You know, and when I was practicing acupuncture and which is a bioenergetic technique as well as a neurological technique, I always had a sense that there was something else cooking. And I didn't know what it was. I still don't know what it is. I played around with Qigong with some of the older Chinese guys that trained me in L.A. I heard all their stories, very charming. I thought there was some stuff going on. And so as somebody who went through a tremendous amount of training and very conventional training and have lived in this sort of very academic world, getting some Reiki treatments and then meeting Pamela and training with her has been something that's brought together for me something that I sort of always felt was there through my other training. And so it was kind of like opening something up for me that was already there. I'm not exclusively a Reiki practitioner. I do lots of other stuff. I'm a chiropractor and acupuncturist. I do a lot of injections. I try to rotate people off of their fentanyl patch and onto levodromaran, which is all very tricky stuff, you know, the complex pharmacology of treating pain patients. Mind-body medicine is a huge part of my practice. But for me, being a second-degree Reiki practitioner, and I have no interest in being a Reiki master because I don't really want to train people. I'll send people to Pamela to get trained. I mean, I love the idea, but it's not really what I do. I feel like having that as another tool in my toolbox, which I've already got a lot of stuff in it, frankly, but it's something that happens for me spontaneously when I'm treating people. I often have people who are very frightened. They're in terrible pain. They've had bad procedures that went badly. They've tried a lot of medications that have not helped them and made them sick as a dog. A lot of these people are terrified. And being sick and being in pain, by definition, you're stressed out. And so if you think about Reiki as just a meditation, and this was the thing that I've said to Pamela many times, but for me, Reiki is a meditation with somebody else. It's that simple. I'm doing a meditation, and I'm with somebody else. And they don't have to believe what I'm doing or anything. It doesn't matter. But if I've got somebody who's in tremendous pain and anxiety and sense of catastrophe, the complexity of treating chronic pain, for me, Reiki is an invaluable tool because not only does it allow me to get still and quiet in the presence of that distress and that person being totally stressed out, but it also gives an opportunity for that patient to get still and quiet and have a moment when I put my hands on. And I'll tell you, very often, I was going to start dancing here. Very often, I'll be doing a procedure in the office. I'll be injecting trigger points. And whether I notice it or not, my hands are activated. They are hot, and they're tingly. And I didn't even take any pills myself to cause this. I didn't smoke anything before I came in the office. This just happens to me now, and it happens pretty much all the time. I can be doing a manipulation where I'm stretching something and trying to move something in a certain direction. My hands will activate, and the something will be going on, like it was many years ago when I was training in Chinese medicine, but it feels more powerful. It feels like that same kind of thing that's been brought into a channel for me, a mode. So I want to stop talking now because I've heard all this stuff before, but I want to ask you all, we have a lot of healthcare providers here and the people who are interested in healthcare. I want you to think about questions that you may have about, because I'm part of the panel to talk about a lot of the integration as a practitioner, how Reiki can be used in a really subtle, non-obvious way. You know, when I'm treating people, if I'm treating people in the hospital or in the office, I don't make any big deal about this. If I want to talk with a person about Reiki or the fact that I do this, I certainly will do that. But most of the time, it just happens. When I'm examining somebody, when I'm doing a procedure, when I'm moving something, when I'm doing acupuncture, it just happens. And for me, it's great. And I think it also helps the patients as far as I can tell. But and I don't have to, you know, put on saffron robes and chant or eat wheatgrass juice or, you know what I'm saying? It's almost seamless. You kind of don't even notice that it's there. And that's one of the things that I like about it. The way Pamela talks about, you have to sort of lose your enthusiasm and just do it. So for me, it's something that's very quiet. And so I want to welcome you. We'll go ahead and see more slides, but I want to welcome you to think of the questions you may have for us. But I have to tell you, I don't believe in this stuff. That's my bottom line.
When people ask me if I believe in Reiki, I ask them if they believe in electricity. You know, it's just, and not that Reiki and electricity are related, it's just that I don't think about whether or not I believe in electricity. I just flip the switch and the lights go on, and I'm very grateful for that. You know? And the same thing with Reiki. It's just, I make the connection, and then what happens, happens. And that's why I keep stressing that it's a practice rather than an intervention, because in a medical intervention, you have these phases, right? If you were my client or patient, then I would have to do some form of diagnosis, figure out what's wrong, have the attitude that there's something wrong that I can fix, and then come up with a treatment plan, implement the treatment plan, back up, reevaluate, and make recommendations moving forward, okay? But if I want to practice Reiki, I just do something like this. I don't even have to be looking at the person. And I certainly don't have to be thinking about it. We're going to spend a little bit of time on the research for people who really want to go into the various studies. It's all in the most updated is the Reiki and Cancer paper that is in the proceedings. And also, the papers are available on my website. Whenever I'm asked to write a medical paper, I put that in my copyright agreement that I can have these papers available to the public. It's hard enough for doctors to find out about them and then find them and download them, but for Reiki practitioners and patients who are interested in Reiki and know that their doctors need to read something in meaningful language, you know, how would they ever access medical literature? So please be aware of that resource for yourselves and the people that you care for. First of all, just the challenges of CAM research, in case any of you were not here yesterday, we need to reconsider the standards for evidence, right? The randomized controlled trial is inappropriate for the kind of complex and multi-level action of complementary and alternative medicine. A systems approach is a better match, or outcomes research. Let's offer Reiki to some people who just had a certain surgery and don't offer Reiki to a matched group of patients and see who gets out of the hospital faster, you know, who takes less medications, etc. The challenges of Reiki research in particular, we have no scientific evidence that Reiki exists, okay? So if we start thinking in that way, we're not going to get very far. Reiki is balancing overall. It doesn't have the kind of action that a pharmaceutical does. It's not unidirectional. Reiki doesn't treat symptoms or conditions directly. Reiki cannot be dosed. We have no reason to assume that somebody who thinks of herself as a Reiki master is a more adept practitioner than a first-degree Reiki practitioner. We have no way to evaluate this. There's no way to compare Reiki practitioners, nor can we assume that a person who has 15 minutes of Reiki touch is getting more than a person who has 5 minutes of Reiki touch. I can tell you that in general, the more acute, the more emergent the situation is, the more dramatic the response to Reiki, which is why 5 to 15 or 20 minutes of Reiki treatment for a hospital bed patient is enormous. Whereas somebody who is very healthy and, you know, just kind of needs a little tweaking to be more balanced may enjoy that, you know, the 30 seconds you had or 5 to 20 minutes, but it's not going to have the same impact, most likely, as a full treatment.
And interestingly enough, that's also a principle in Chinese medicine. I was trained that people who are really sick, you want to give them a very light and quick treatment, and very often you see dramatic results with a relatively short treatment. And I've experienced that with Reiki as well.
In vitro may not represent the complexity of the human system. And the argument for in vitro research is, well, if we can see what's happening at the level of a cell, then we can what? You know, what can we do with this? What we can say is that, okay, we've shown that there's a response at the cellular level to maybe Reiki or maybe something else. We can't hold a cell, you know. And I was fortunate, I was invited to play around in a very prestigious nerve lab, and we had different petri dishes that were fed different things to, you know, see how they would respond to being held in Reiki hands. And it was myself and another practitioner who is related to me by blood. My daughter comes in very handy in these experiments. And I asked specifically that there be one petri dish that was not fed, because I wanted to have some really stressed nerve cells there. Not that nerve cells aren't stressed when they're separated from the body anyway, but... And sure enough, we just did some Reiki, and they watched it and saw... the first thing that the researcher saw was that this is not a very good way to study the impact of Reiki. You know, and she didn't really know anything about Reiki other than the 45-minute presentation I gave to her team. But she did notice that the petri dish that had no nutrients showed more response than the petri dishes that were nourished, which, you know, is certainly not proof of anything, but very much in line with what we were just saying. How do we document the response to Reiki treatment? You know, this really has to be thought through. And in outcomes research, what kind of outcomes are we looking for? The research evidence that we have, I want to be very clear, it is beginning. You know, there's not a lot. There are no large randomized controlled trials. But what we are seeing, and it may be remarkable that we're seeing physiologic responses to Reiki treatment. We're seeing decreased heart rate and improved heart rate variability. How many people are familiar with heart rate variability? Okay, I'm going to just give you, you know, a real simple primer. Basically, the heart is not supposed to beat like a metronome. There, you know, in nature, there's always some play, some variability. And in heart rate, there's a number of different types of variability. When the heart rate becomes more rigid, more mechanical, that is a bad sign. That's a sign of a stressed system. When the heart rate variability becomes more resilient, more elastic within normal ranges, then that's a sign of a system that is recovering from stress. And if you want to know more about this, you can look at Bruce McEwen's work on allostatic load, allostasis and allostatic load. He's here at Rockefeller University. HRV, McEwen articulated, I think, 11 different measures, but heart rate variability seems to be a shorthand for all of them. And the importance of this is that it takes stress from being a subjective, you know, self-report measure to something that we can actually measure and report on and get hard data, both the degree to which the system is stressed and the response to interventions. Heart rate variability is so important that a flattened HRV is the single strongest predictor of another myofascial infarction after once the patient's been hospitalized. So we did a study at Yale in which we looked at HRV for patients within 72 hours of a heart attack, to see, first of all, could this be done in the cardiac ICU? And secondly, what would be the impact? And we found that Reiki significantly improved heart rate variability and reduced anxiety, both compared to music and compared to the patient's mean. So patients were compared to themselves, because it can be tricky trying to use a control group otherwise. Improved blood pressure. Note, I don't say reduced blood pressure, because if people's blood pressure is low, Reiki's not going to make it lower, right? But if people have high blood pressure, I have many students, and one of them is a Columbia epidemiologist, a PhD, very hyper-educated, hyper-functioning woman who's been practicing Reiki, self-treatment for about 10 years, and she says as long as she stays with her self-treatment, she doesn't have to take her medications. And if she's traveling, if she's very busy and she drops it out, her blood pressure goes up. Improved immune indicators, decreased levels of stress hormones, and subjective improvements in anxiety and pain. I mentioned one study. There are many others. Improved mood and functioning of depressed patients. I just want to talk about this study for 1 minute because it had a fairly good size. There were 3 arms with 15 patients each. 2 arms received Reiki, either distant treatment or hands-on treatment, and 1 arm was the control group. People who got Reiki received a weekly treatment for 6 weeks in a row. They were tested, I think, 4 different standardized scales for, like, the Beck hopelessness scale was one of them and 3 others. And both Reiki groups showed significant improvement in self-report regarding their depressive symptoms. But what's really interesting is that a year later, when these patients were retested, they had held their improvement. And enhanced well-being and increased vitality. I have a nonprofit organization, the Institute for the Advancement of Complementary Therapies, IACT. And for 3 years, we had a funded Reiki program at St. Vincent's Comprehensive Cancer Center, an off-site affiliate of St. Vincent's Hospital. We offered over 400 Reiki treatments to mostly outpatients, but also family members and some staff, as often as we could get our hands on them. The treatments were 5 minutes, because sometimes a patient was called into the doctor, and up to 55 minutes at the longest. Whenever feasible, we asked the recipients to fill out VAS scales, you know, 0 to 10, pain scales, anxiety scales, before and after. And of the patients who reported either pain and or anxiety before their treatment, 97% of them reported that their pain and or anxiety was reduced by the treatment. You know? And, I mean, this is not bench research, you know. This is not hard data, but the number is kind of staggering. There's a lot of people there. And a patient's perception. We know that pain is what the person says it is, and anxiety is the same. So if patients feel that they're improving, that's a good thing. And also, so many of them wrote at the bottom of their VAS how good they felt about the hospital, that they would provide that kind of care. And go through. I want to go to suggestions for future research. There's just 2 more slides I want to do. Let's include an experienced Reiki master in all phases of the research, from design through the interpretation. I suggest studying first degree and self-treatment. We can't dose, so why not have Reiki-naive participants teach them to treat themselves and see what they get out of it? Remember Wayne Jonas and the others yesterday on the panel for healthcare policy talking about how difficult it is to make behavioral change. Well, this is a pretty easy behavioral change to make. Study the immediate effects in trauma treatment because of what James was just mentioning. Study recovery, the length of stay in hospitals, infections, meds. Study long-term measures like that year later, the depressed patient still feeling better. Document stress reduction, but please don't call Reiki a stress reduction technique. Document patient satisfaction, and study Reiki like Richard Davidson at Madison is studying meditation. If only we had somebody with access to the machines that he uses who is a Reiki practitioner. And Wayne Jonas said this yesterday too, let's study healing. What can be generalized? So we don't have to study acupuncture and Reiki and meditation and, you know, all these things for back pain. If we understood more about how the body heals, maybe we could generalize more among these different modalities. These are current NCAM studies, and here's the one that I was looking for. The mechanism of action for Reiki is as yet unknown. Science does not know how Reiki works. Remember that aspirin was used for 70 years before science understood its mechanism of action. I think of Reiki as the resting cure. You know, what's old is new again. And there is growing research documenting that Reiki treatment seems to gently influence the system toward balance. A side effect of balance is a reduction of stress. You know what the resting cure is? You know, 100 years ago, people would be sent to the mountains. Fresh air, maybe running water, they would rest. Nowadays, if we were sent to the mountains and there wasn't a casino there, we'd probably just get more stressed, right? Because we don't know how to rest. We've lost the capacity to shift back into the parasympathetic nervous system dominance. So I propose, and this is just my theory from my clinical observations, that Reiki, and actually there's some research to support this, that Reiki enables the body to shift to parasympathetic nervous system dominance through vagal nerve stimulation. And in that state, the body resets its self-regulating mechanisms, thus aiding self-healing. Reiki healing, you often hear people speak about the energy coming through the Reiki practitioner, but I want to challenge that because Reiki healing really happens from within. What the Reiki practitioner offers that is really Reiki, and I'm not saying that energy might not be coming through because we all have that going on, but what is Reiki? How is Reiki different from energy medicine? That touch is like an applied meditation that gives an access to that place of wellness within the system. And we know that once we start paying attention to something, whether it's an itch or it's a sense of peacefulness, it expands, right? It's like bringing that remembered wellness to the forefront of our attention.
Can I say just one thing quickly?
You may say more than one thing. I'm finished.
Well, I just want to say, you know, I try to teach most of my patients some kind of mind-body therapy because they're all stressed out, they're all in pain, they're all distraught about what's been going on with them, and I've got to get them to what Herbert Benson at Harvard referred to as the relaxation response, because Benson defined that if you can get someone into the relaxation response as defined by his research, there are all sorts of very hard, measurable, physiological things that go on in the body. You can measure all this stuff, like heart rate variability, like changes in the hormones, the adrenaline levels go down, the stress, the cortisol hormones go down. All these things that Benson measured as being part of the relaxation response. If I can get my patients to get even close to the relaxation response, and many of them are in too much pain, you know, their neck pain has gone on and on and on and on forever. If I can get them close to the relaxation response, I know, according to the Harvard research, that all these measurable physiological things are going to change. They're going to quiet down. Now, that's a meditation response. And so for me, as Pam was talking about this, I think about parasympathetic nervous system dominance and the tremendous amount of research we have in the whole field of psychoneuroimmunology, which came out of Benson's work, and the relaxation response. For me, offering Reiki is an invitation to meditation. And so many of my patients tell me they've tried to do the breath work, they've gotten the tapes, they've done this and they've done that. They've, you know, sat with their feet exactly 6 inches apart and stuck their tongue up under the roof of their mouth and tried to inhale through one nostril and out through the other, and they can't do it. How many people have told you they can't meditate? And you know that if you can get that person to start stopping, to start learning how to be still, and let all the stuff that's going on just flow by in a mindfulness meditation model where you don't judge it, you're going to put somebody into the relaxation response. And their physiology, measurable physiology, is going to change. So for me, I think what goes on when I offer Reiki to someone, it is an invitation to meditate with me that is almost impossible for them not to do. Does that make any sense? Does that sound completely insane?
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, I always hear from people. I was a meditation teacher before I learned Reiki. I'd also been practicing meditation and yoga for about 25 years before I learned Reiki in 1986, which is why my perspective on Reiki is different than other people, because I just had that cultural context already. But so many people would say, you know, no, I can't meditate. I mean, I have a harder time staying out of meditation than I do going into meditation. So it took me a long time to realize that this was a major obstacle. And really, that's why I became a Reiki master, because I saw that once people experienced Reiki or learned to practice for themselves, meditation opened up for them in a whole different way. And experience meditators who learned Reiki, their meditation deepened. I want to share a story of a patient that we collaborated on, James's patient, my client. And I often feel like saying to, and I sometimes do say to pain doctors, send me your hopeless cases. Okay? So James sent me one of them. She wasn't hopeless, but she was in pain.
She needed your services, pal. Yeah.
So we did one treatment, and I encourage people to learn to practice. We did one treatment. She came to the class. She had limited, I know there's somebody here I can't see. She had limited mobility, so I had to give her a modified self-treatment that she could do. And then she came for another treatment, and that was it. And then I never heard from her. I did notice that after the two treatments, and, you know, clients often say, well, what did you experience? You know, they want that psychic reading, and I declined to do that. I'd rather elicit their experience. And after both treatments, she shared a profound insight about her own life, which I thought was interesting, and I see that a lot with Reiki. I saw James at the Integrative Pain Conference that he and Freddie Rosenthal used to have at Freddie Cronenberg at the Rosenthal Center. How many people do that, right? At Columbia. He used to host. There was a wonderful event, and James came up to me and was very appreciative that this patient of his had a 40% improvement in her pain. And I listened, and, you know, of course I love to get that feedback, because who knows where patients go and what happens afterwards. But it really made me appreciate, as a non-medical practitioner, what it's like on that side, because I didn't consider her a success story. She still had a lot of pain, you know, and I felt that if only she had come back and we'd done a couple more treatments or done them a little closer together, she could have had a much more relief. It reminded me of the first doctor who called me about, you know, he was thinking of referring a patient to me. I'm on the phone, this was 1,000 years ago, and he said, so how many treatments should I tell her to come for? 10? And I went, yeah. Yeah, 10. We'll definitely buy 10. Because what we get, you know, James said that he's at the end of the line. No, you know, we're really at the end of the line by the time they've exhausted all medical options. Or on the other side, we get people who are like Reiki flaky. You know, they're going to have one Reiki treatment and it's going to change their lives. Or they're going to learn to practice Reiki, but they're not going to practice. You know, it's magical thinking. So the idea of, wow, doctors understand it takes time. That is a wonderful thing in terms of medical collaboration.
And I wish that we could do these interventions. I mean, we're talking about Pamela and I being sort of at the end of the line for people who have not done so well with all the other things that we throw at them, conventional and unconventional. I would love to see more of this done earlier on in relatively simple conditions.
Like the waiting room.
Like the waiting room and postoperatively. I can't tell you how many people I have seen who had a surgery, and the surgery may actually have been quite good. They've had their rotator cuff repaired. They've had their ACL repaired in their knee. But they didn't do well. They didn't do well with the rehabilitation. They didn't do well with managing the pain afterwards. And it's my contention, if I could get my hands on some of these people earlier and supervise appropriate rehab and hands-on work and something like Reiki, specifically Reiki, and a decent diet. You know, if somebody just had their ACL repair and they're getting all their meals handed to them through their car window. You know, they're not going to do so well with healing.
And, if it comes through a window, you shouldn't eat it.
That's not good. It's not good. No, but and the other thing you have to understand is that as practitioners, we're super not reductionistic. We understand the role of everything that's being talked about at this conference and at this conference and many others. But this is a powerful tool for us. And so I would love to see all these ortho cases and neurosurgery cases right after they come off the table and be able to do Reiki and mobilize them properly and deal with the whole stress of admission and the pain and stress of the rehabilitation. I think we'd have a lot fewer failed surgeries down the road that I see 2 years later, and they're a mess. And their life is a mess. And their emotional world is a mess.
What I would suggest, though, and that's all very good, but if I can only give somebody one Reiki treatment, I do it before surgery. An ounce of prevention. You know, get that system as centered, as balanced, as strong, the best integrity we can in the system before we stress it.
And it's been shown by Blue Cross Blue Shield of California that the tape, they sent out Bellruth Napperstack's pre-surgery tape.
Uh-huh.
They saved, for elective surgeries, they saved an average of $800 on those cases compared to people who didn't get the meditation tape. And so if we think about Reiki as a centering and a form of meditation, then it's likely to have a similar kind of effect that Blue Cross Blue Shield shows.
And if we remember that meditation has physiologic and biochemical responses. You know, it's just not like, oh, this is so nice, I feel so centered, I feel at one with all of you, you
woo,
know.
Woo.
It's like, no, my heart rate has changed, the level of stress hormones in my blood has changed. You know, my body has moved from eating itself up to rebuilding itself. This is a good thing. Any questions? Why don't you...
Could you talk about the difference between Reiki and therapeutic touch or healing touch?
Sorry.
That's yours.
Okay, so this is a real simple question because I actually talked about it a little bit before. Reiki is a spiritual healing practice, and therapeutic touch and healing touch are healthcare interventions that are, you know, very worthwhile, very valuable, but they're interventions. They're kind of like reordering the person's biofield, you know, which is a good thing. It's like cleaning the room. You know, this is a good thing. But it doesn't, to my experience and my understanding, it's not making that inner spiritual connection that happens with Reiki. So it's a completely different mechanism of action.
Is it just purely placing your hands?
Yes. At the first degree level, it's facilitated through touch. And the reason why I can say that, besides my own understanding, but how I've seen it in practice, is that the ER docs and the first responders that I've either trained or have interviewed tell me story after story of how, you know, they're very focused on stabilizing that patient. And then when things start to calm down, they notice that their hands have activated. And they never thought about Reiki. They were totally focused on their...
That's what happens to me a lot in the office. I don't even intend to offer Reiki.
See, and that's an advantage that Reiki offers over therapeutic touch and healing touch, just because it doesn't have to be a standalone. Not because it's bigger, better, or whatever. Yes?
For clinicians that don't touch their patients, mm-hmm. Would first degree Reiki have any benefit to the patient?
Yes. And I would like everybody to remember this. The care of the patient begins with the care of the caregiver. So if you never get to touch your patients, if you learn to practice Reiki on yourself and you go home and your kids say, no, you know, don't come near me with those Reiki hands, doesn't matter, because you practice on yourself.
And
everything is influenced.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you just talk a little about the attunement process?
Well, I have a hard time talking a little, period. But the initiation process, there's not much that I can say about it other than this is the way that practices are traditionally shared from a master practitioner to a student in indigenous cultures. And we have some sense of this in the West, in of lineage, you know, and initiation, in the sense that we'll say, well, you know, I got my undergraduate degree at Yale, and then I went to Harvard Medical School. Or we see doctors going to for a particular program because they want to study with a particular doctor. Or an artist wants to study with a particular painter. You know, that there's something about connecting with a teacher in a direct way that is a little different than reading a book, right? Yeah, I can only address that metaphorically, and my favorite metaphor currently is that this is a computer, here's the hardware, and then we're just downloading some software that makes connections among pieces of the hardware so that it's discovered a new talent that it had. It's not the initiations in my experience, and I've been practicing, I've been a Reiki master for, I don't know, I think almost 19 years now, is that I'm not giving my students something, I'm not imposing something on them, I'm giving them an ability to access something that is already who they are, to access their essence.
Can you talk about long distance Reiki on the phone?
Yeah, Reiki doesn't go over the phone. It's the voice that goes over the phone. So we often do consultations with distant healing. But distant healing, it's not long distance, short distance, it's just not touch. So I could be doing a distant healing for somebody who is 3 feet away, or they could be in Beijing. It doesn't matter. It's a different technique. It's a different level of practice, a different scope of practice, but it's still Reiki. To my understanding, if you can trace the practice back to Usui, it's Reiki. But you should know that there are practices being billed as Reiki that have been channeled, and I don't know why anybody would call that Reiki other than for commercial reasons, frankly.
We got to wrap up.
Yeah, we got to wrap. So we got two questions. And
are you still offering Reiki training in the area?
Yeah, I am. I'm on the Upper West Side, and my next training is next week. You know, I have a website, and I send out monthly, if you're lucky, you get a monthly email from me. I also, on the JCC, which is on the Upper West Side, I have a monthly Reiki clinic the first Thursday of every month. You can come if you're a practitioner and practice with us. You can come if you're a public, or, you know, you have friends, maybe you're a practitioner and you want to talk to your sister about Reiki, but she doesn't want to hear it from you. You know, you can suggest she comes. It's $20. And people, it's on my website. It's the JCC Manhattan, but my website is reikiinmedicine.org. Here's my contact information. Or you can Google Pamela Miles Reiki.
And not to be outdone, I also have a website. It's just drdillard.com, drdillard.com.